is Women's Rights, a podcast about women's ordination, written and produced by students at Smith College. Hi, I'm Maya.
And I'm Anjali.
And I'm Miriam. We're your hosts for this episode of Women's Rights.
This season, we are exploring the story of women's ordination in American Zen Buddhism, Judaism, and the Episcopal Church. To do so, we've interviewed women in each of these traditions, some of whom were in the first generation of ordained women within their religious communities.
In this episode, we're going to look at Reform Judaism. We're going to ask Rabbi Nancy Flamm what it means to be a woman rabbi in Reform Judaism and hear about her experiences.
Woman rabbi in American Reform Judaism, Sally Priesthand, was ordained in 1972 after over 100 years of women's activism and advocacy for reform. These women held leadership roles outside of the rabbinate and forged the path for the women rabbis to come. Rabbi Flamm began her process of ordination in 1982 after Priesthand had opened the doors for women to become rabbis, and we were interested in seeing how things had changed for women and what an individual woman's path to ordination looked like at the end of the 20th century.
To begin, we asked Rabbi Flamm about her involvement with Judaism and the Jewish community when she was young to help us understand her background story and how she found her way to ordination. Contrary to what many would expect of a future rabbi, Rabbi Flamm grew up somewhat disconnected from her religion.
So I grew up in Los Angeles County, and I grew up in a Reform family. So I was born in 1960, and that wasn't so long after the Holocaust, actually. And I would say that my parents' unconscious, if not conscious, orientation in the late 50s and early 60s was to lead a life where one wouldn't stick out as a Jew. So we were in a suburban, you know, pretty modest tract. I mean, what used to be orange fields in orange orchards in California. And we did belong to a synagogue, Temple Judea, where we went to Sunday school, which I feared and hated, actually, and I will tell you why. Two main reasons. The boys were out of control. They were like, the teacher did not have control of the classroom. It was your typical, this is Sunday school, this is not real school, you know, no one takes it seriously, there are no consequences, which sadly still pertains in many places today. But the boys were out of control, and they would, you know, I was a pretty timid, shy little girl, and they would light matches during recess and throw them in the classroom. I mean, I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. Okay. Reason number one, reason number two is that what we learned was not lived in my home. So there was no context. There was no place to root what we were learning. It just seemed like something other in a certain kind of way. So really every Sunday morning, I can still remember, almost remember what it felt like to have those stomach aches, you know, before going and pleading not to go. So that was not an auspicious beginning for someone who ended up becoming a rabbi.
Despite an unlikely introduction to Judaism in her family, Rabbi Flamm began to find religious awakening through community, important women in her life who opened up the world.
I had a next door neighbor. We were on a little cul-de-sac of five houses, and I had a next door neighbor. We called everybody aunt or uncle. Aunt Esther. Aunt Esther took an interest in my Jewish identity. So Aunt Esther gave me one Hanukkah, my first little necklace that had a Magen David in it. And I wore that and I felt very proud about it. And then I had a friend in middle school, Susan Goldstein, who whose family also took an interest in my Jewish soul, if you will, speaking metaphorically. And they were active in their synagogue, their Reform synagogue. And I would sometimes go with my friend Susan to class, or there was a particular mentor who actually had us over to his home for Shabbat, and that felt so special. And he was so cool. And, you know, we were learning things that were relevant to our life as teens.
While Rabbi Flam found solace in Jewish community, much of her spiritual development happened during her time at Dartmouth College. She described to us the ways in which both community and religious leadership helped her inform her ongoing interest in religion and theology.
I had a kind of religious awakening in college, which came about through finding my people. It was not a place hospitable to Jews. I didn't find the atmosphere really intellectual. I mean, the life of the mind was another refuge for me, life of the spirit, life of the mind. Anyway, I ended up living in an alternative house. We used to joke, all the true intellectuals, all the artists, all the radical political people all lived in one house. We all fit in one house on campus. Anyway, it was a great house. And I began to really have this sense of belonging, and also really was beginning to heal from my earlier trauma growing up. And I took some classes, particularly a class with Fred Berthold in science and religion, that just blew my mind. I started taking religion courses. It was when I was having this big religious awakening. I say I had a conversion from a secular, pretty much secular, to a religious person. I didn't know what kind of religious person. I just began to feel the world was alive in a way I had never really felt before, and that it called my attention and responsibility. And what happened in college is, and so religion, it's all I cared about. It's all I studied about. I mean, I was, you know, I'm kind of an intense person, a little, not, I wouldn't say obsessive, but I really like to go for, you know, what I find interesting. So I took all religion classes once I filled requirements.
Good mentors are often essential in encouraging women to seek out ordination. After her religious awakening, one major influence on Rabbi Flam was Rabbi Larry Edwards at Dartmouth. She told us about three things he did that really changed her life and convinced her to become a rabbi.
One was, I had an accident. I was part of an Outward Bound group living house before I found my people, looking for my people. They were not my people. Anyway, but I was part of this Outward Bound house, and we did this big winter skiing fiasco. Anyway, I hurt myself. I was on crutches, and I had been away for the year because I was hadn't found my people and wasn't feeling comfortable at Dartmouth. And when I came back, I hurt myself, and Larry Edwards remembered me from my freshman year. And as I was limping across the street on crutches, he just said, you know, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm okay. And then I was like, I burst out tear, you know, crying, and sat with him, and he took me to his home, and he like fed me real food. And he's just so kind. And, when I had, so it was the first piece. The second was when I had my religious awakening. I went to a Passover Seder, and I really had a sense, if you will, of the living God. That is to say, I felt in my body, it was like just a living experience for me. And when we went around the Passover table, and everyone was reading out of the Haggadah, and every time people came to the word God, they just read it as if it were another word, like book, shoe, dog, God. And it was like, how can you just read the word God and not, you know, be there? Anyway, I stayed for about 2/3 of the Seder, and then I had to go back to my dorm room, and I wrote this, you know, feverish letter to Rabbi Edwards, you know, like, and I gave it to him, and God bless him. You know, he didn't say, honey, you better go to the mental health department. You know, he sat and he listened. He respected my religious life, my inner life. He didn't ask me a million questions. I don't know if he understood a thing I was saying, but he was so kind and present. And the third thing he did is really, for some reason, I do not know, he saw leadership potential in me. Really, have no idea why. And he sent me to one of the early Hillel conferences, leadership training, long weekends, I think it was. And that was an incredible time of meeting just incredible people. Anyway, he was a great influence on my decision to pursue the rabbinate.
Breaks from tradition and transference of power rarely come from those comfortably in charge. Different groups of Judaism have been arguing this topic for decades and have come to differing conclusions. Coming less than 20 years after the ordination of the first woman rabbi, Sally Priestand, in the United States, Rabbi Flam's path to leadership was shaped by those women who had come before her. We wanted to know what it meant for her to be a woman seeking ordination and if that created barriers to her success. First, she told us about her experience in graduate school and bonding with a fellow female student.
I went to what was at that time called the University of Judaism, UJ. It's now called something else. It's in California. Maybe it's called the American Jewish University or something like that. It's part of the conservative movement. They were not ordaining women at the time. But you could enter their master's in rabbinic literature program. So that's what I did, but it was all guys except me and one other woman. They were all in the rabbinic track because they could be. And we were just studying rabbinic literature. It felt very foreign to be in such a male. I mean, I come from Dartmouth, but I made, you know, fast feminist friends. It was very foreign. Of course, all the literature was literature written by men from male perspective. All these guys were studying for the rabbinate. So certainly I was in an outsider status. I just have to say that my friend and I, the one other woman, we became chavruta, we became study partners, and we made sure that we got the highest marks in the class, and we did. So just saying, a little point of pride.
Her parents didn't oppose her decision or stop her from pursuing ordination, but they still didn't quite understand it, which shows how Jews were still warming up to the idea of women's ordination as it grew over time.
Anyway, when I told them I was studying for the rabbinate, my mother did say, "What's a nice Jewish girl doing studying for the rabbinate?" So, you know, it was really funny. I mean, it didn't deter me. It wasn't an obstacle, but my parents certainly didn't understand my decision. They were supportive, but it seemed very strange. Of course, one of the reasons I hungered so much was because there was so little nourishing fare.
However, ultimately, Rabbi Flam didn't see herself as having experienced all that many obstacles due to her gender.
I think as a woman, I'm not aware of other obstacles. I really feel like by the time I started, which was 1982, so Sally Priestand had been out a decade, is that right, from 72? So, I mean, it was still in the early days, of course, and anyone who was ordained a woman, rabbi, you know, you all knew each other, but I had other obstacles. I had theological obstacles. They were more substantive than any obstacles as a woman.
With women's ordination in general, there's usually a debate over whether women are uniquely skilled at leadership in different ways due to their gender, or if there's no difference between women and men as leaders at all. Regardless of claims of biological essentialism, we wanted to know if Rabbi Flam's womanhood had affected her leadership. If it hadn't been too much of an obstacle for her, as she told us, had she found it a source of strength in her position as a rabbi?
My work is completely informed by my womanhood.
Rabbi Flam co-founded the National Center for Jewish Healing and told us about how gender influenced their leadership model in working together.
It was always a collective endeavor. In the Jewish community, traditionally, there's been a big, tradition, you could say, or pattern of the lone male leader, charismatic, brilliant, speaking and leading. And we didn't want to do the lone charismatic leader for many reasons. For many reasons, some of which you can, you know, you're very aware of. We also felt, why do anything alone? I mean, we learn from each other. We can support each other's intuitions about the divine, about what should happen in our work. So it was extremely collective. We never taught alone. We always taught in pairs. Why? Two reasons. We didn't want the teaching of Jewish spirituality to be about us. We didn't want to be, it's about the teaching, not the teacher. So, our work was always about getting ourselves out of the way so that other people could flourish. In a traditional model, you know, there's a lot of big egos there. You have to have an ego to appear in the world. You know, I'm speaking with an ego now. I want to come across as cogent, and, you know, there's some theatrics, and I'm very aware of how to use self. But in our teaching, and in particular our retreat teaching, our counseling, it's all about the wisdom of the tradition. It's not about who I am. So that was reason one. Reason two, we wanted not to burn out. You know, we wanted to be able to support each other through our work and give each other care and support and feedback. So again, I would say, did it just happen that we were women and found this model? I don't think so. I think the more nurturing, supportive, get the ego out of the way model of always working in pairs also came from our lives as women and our education as feminists. We used to joke, friends don't let friends teach alone. So, tremendous strength. And I still draw on that strength in my work today, for sure, of being a woman.
Rabbi Flam's discussions of leading in pairs and groups with other women tied easily into our next question. In what ways had the historical context of primarily male-ordained leadership within her tradition influenced the form and style of traditional leadership? And how had her presence as a woman impacted how she embodied the role of leadership?
I think the only other piece I would add is in the work of the Institute for Jewish Spirituality, it's very much influenced by Buddhist psychology, mindfulness work is one stream. It's a Jewish organization that has taken wisdom and practice from other traditions, always, you know, transparently, or hopefully transparently. And I had a teacher, David Sperling, Bible teacher in seminary, who used to say the genius of the Jewish tradition is not having everything it needs, but because we've lived in every culture in the world, is knowing what the best from the cultures we've lived in could be incorporated into a Jewish life. And so the Institute for Jewish Spirituality very much is in that model with understanding the importance of embodied practice through yoga, spiritual direction from the Catholic tradition, and also mindfulness meditation from the Buddhist tradition. So in the work that we did, our focus was always on, I spoke about this a little bit in terms of authority, on the truth of one's experience. So we were always about empowerment. As I say that, you know, each person is an authority on their experience. Rather than sometimes we would talk about there's a guru model of teaching in the Jewish tradition, we weren't in that model. We were in the empowerment model. And that kind of changes everything. That kind of changes everything. It wasn't about selling ourselves. It was an invitational kind of work. If this appeals to you, you know, this has really helped us. You know, if you look at the way that we're working with our minds and our bodies and our hearts, and, you know, it looks like we're being skillful or know something, you know, you want to have what she's having, you know, from, is that Harry Met Sally? You know, it's like, yeah, that's an example of a person. I want to know, how did they develop their own heart and mind? Great. But always very much an empowerment model, not, I know the answer for you. So in a way, I think it our being women inspired the form and content of everything we did, particularly with the Institute. Yeah. Yeah.
Finally, we wanted to know how Rabbi Flam viewed her role as a religious leader in the context of recent events surrounding white supremacy and anti-Semitism. Despite not being a current congregational leader, her experiences illuminated many of the experiences of those in the Jewish community.
I'll just speak personally, you know, in our kids' lives, for instance, they went to Jewish day school through grade six. And we have a very tight Jewish community here. I mean, I remember my kids being shocked in middle school when they learned, you mean in this country, it's fewer than 2% of people are Jewish? You know, they were like, what? You know, because we lived in a very, you know, kind of rich, tight-knit Jewish community. And they're always fighting fights of liberation, but not of the Jewish people. You know, they were always activists. You know, I talked about my daughter was very, very active in the Trans Asylum Seeker Network right now. It's kind of her big commitment. And my husband grew up in a family, a Holocaust survivor generation and relatives, family, and, you know, anti-Semitism was just always on the mind. Our kids did not grow up with that view. And it's been a shock for some, I think, in their 20s in this country, to wake up to the reality of anti-Semitism, you know, not just, you know, the Tree of Life massacre or other, you know, outward massacres, but, you know, people wearing t-shirts on the January 6th insurrection, you know, what about the other 6 million or, you know, go get the other, you know, you will not replace us. I mean, it's hard to assimilate. And so I think the leadership has been responding to the kind of thawing of denial of younger people, you know, because they see, oh my gosh, my parents are, like, you know, very well off financially. They made it. They're professionals. You know, so many Jews in the, I mean, it almost sounds to sound, you know, anti-Semitic, but, you know, so many Jews in media, so many Jews in Hollywood, like, you know, what do you mean? Jews are very successful by and large in this country, which is true. And for complicated reasons, and we won't go into those, but I mean, it's not like every immigrant group got the pass in terms of being white, the Jews got, but that's a whole big deal to talk about. So I think there's been growing sensitivity in leadership that particularly young people in their 20s and 30s need a certain kind of education and support to even understand, oh my gosh, I'm also part of a hated and targeted group. It's hard for people, young people who are you know, social justice activists. They've been out there, but they've never identified themselves as being in a group that was also targeted. It's kind of a complicated piece of identity work. And so I do think that leadership has grown sensitive. People my age, like we grew up with an understanding about anti-Semitism and, you know, that it never goes away and that it rears its head when conditions are right. And you don't have to scratch very hard to see where it is. And of course, we've seen what's been happening in Europe all these years. So, I mean, you know, like in Poland or other places where there's, you know, been more out anti-Semitism. So it's a really good question. And it's part of the whole, you know, violence against multi-heritage living in the United States. It's the violence against difference. It's the violence against sharing. You know, it's the violence against justice. And so we're part of a much bigger cultural moment in this country. And you know, God willing, we're going to be able to see a world where even those who feel so threatened from difference, those who feel so threatened, you know, by brown and black people in particular, by women, by Jews, by Muslims, you know, by anyone they don't identify with, hopefully they will grow to see there's a new day dawning, and the old time it's gone. Yeah, I guess that's my prayer. Okay. Yeah, we can say amen. Amen, amen. Yeah.
Women's ordination has been a long time coming. It has been hard fought for. There are now hundreds of female rabbis across the globe in Reform, Reconstructionist, and Orthodox Judaism. While each rabbi had to go through their own journey to get to where they are today, they all built off the work the others had done before them. The mentorship they offered each other spiritually and materially was invaluable. Judaism is a faith that knows to value community, and women have always been an essential part of community. Now, as ordained leaders, they can play an even more direct role in other people's lives. Our podcast for today. Special thanks to Rabbi Nancy Flam and Professor David Howlett. Also, thanks to Dan Bennett and Travis Grady of Smith Learning, Research, and Technology team. And thanks to the Andrew Mellon Foundation that supports public-facing student writing at Smith College. Tune in next time on Women's Rights.